It's Friday, May 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, an American citizen faces charges he joined Islamic State. VOA was in the courtroom. Despite Ramadan, Baghdad suffers bombing casualties.
But it's part of a picture of a much wider political struggle that's been going on in Papua New Guinea for some years.
Political turmoil in Papua New Guinea. Also ahead, saying goodbye to a boxing legend. It's all on today's International Edition. An American citizen who fled the United States and joined the Islamic State terror group before having a change of heart is now back in the country to face terror charges. He appeared a short time ago in a Virginia courtroom for the first of several legal appearances. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden was in the courtroom and is now in our studio. Jeff, tell us more about this person and what he's charged with.
Yeah, Muhammad Jamal Kwaisa, a 26-year-old American from Alexandria, Virginia, was flown back to the United States from Erbil in northern Iraq on Wednesday, and he appeared in court on Thursday afternoon. He came to the courtroom. He looked a little bit bent over, a little tired, a little ragged. He looked at his parents the first time he's seen his parents since he left to join the Islamic State back in December of 2015. They waved at him. It was a preliminary hearing, though. They set two new hearings, a detention hearing for in a week and then a probable cause hearing in 2 weeks. And he also had a time earlier to meet a little bit with his lawyer. And so the case will go from here. But he is charged. And by his own admissions, both in an interview he gave with Kurdistan 24 television days after he was captured or surrendered to Kurdish forces, and then in subsequent interrogations with FBI investigators, that he purposely left, sought out the Islamic State to join, had a change of heart and left. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because it seems like there could be ramifications on many levels in terms of intelligence, in terms of perhaps sending a message to would-be jihadists, and also in terms of the potential he poses or gives the United States in its countering violent extremism efforts to deter would-be jihadists and convince them perhaps this isn't the way to go.
What are some of the details that we know so far about his involvement with Islamic State?
Well, he gave a number of details in his interview with Kurdish television. He said that he had left in December 2015. He got to Syria by first flying to London, and then from London they got over to Turkey, and from Turkey crossed the border to Raqqa. He said in the television interview he gave that there was a girl involved, that he had gone over to see a girl who made the arrangements and helped get him to the Islamic State. In the government filing, in the criminal complaint that was filed and unsealed on Thursday, there's no mention of a girl. The other details he confirms, but he says that he traveled from Turkey to Raqqa, the capital of the self-declared caliphate, with four other foreign recruits, none of whom were American, but foreigners who were looking to join Islamic State. Other details hold up, but there are some discrepancies. And according to the criminal complaint, according to what he told the FBI investigators, he said that some of the things he said during the interview on Kurdish TV, he changed, he fudged for self-protection.
Hmm. The aspect of the girl is rather interesting, because doesn't Islamic State tend to use women as kind of a lure, as part of their sales pitch, if you will, to get recruits in?
That was one of the aspects of his story that had intelligence officials and analysts in the private sector very interested and very curious, and it raised question marks, because usually the use of women by the Islamic State, it's the honeypot trap where there's a girl waiting at the destination, mm-hmm. a girl for you to marry, or a girl, you know, for you to, however the Islamic State chooses to use them. But that's at the end. That's when you get there. In this case, he was talking about a girl who was a facilitator, who basically got him into the Islamic State. He actually gave details about her, saying that she was the sister of a woman who was married to an Islamic State fighter. Now, is it possible that such a woman exists? It could be, but it's not reflected as yet in the government pleading, in the criminal complaint that was unsealed.
A fascinating case, and fresh out of the courtroom, National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, thank you so much, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this again.
Anytime.
Time now for our social media segment with G. Abby Lee. She joins me here in Studio 22 for a look at what people are talking about online. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
Well, the big news here in the United States, of course, is the president's endorsement of Hillary Clinton. Tell us about that.
Sure. President Obama endorsed Democratic contender Hillary Clinton Thursday, and before the endorsement, he also met with her rival Bernie Sanders for a meeting. In the endorsement video, Obama highly praised her, and he said he doesn't think there has ever been someone so qualified to hold the office. That's a big praise, right?
That sure is.
Of course, the presumptive Democratic nominee shared that endorsement video on both Facebook and Twitter. She captioned it, "Honored to have you with me. I am fired up and ready to go."
Well, what's the online reaction like? And are people talking about this meeting with Bernie Sanders, too?
They are. One of the most liked comments to her Facebook post was by a man named Charles. And he wrote, "Meeting with Bernie Sanders before making this announcement shows how much class Barack Obama has. He is a great president, and it will be very interesting to see what he does after his term is up." More than 5,000 people liked that reply within 2 hours. Others still went back to the time when Obama and Clinton were competing against each other for the White House position. A user named Matthew wrote a quote by Mr. Obama in 2008 in which he said, "Hillary Clinton will say anything and change nothing."
So what was the gist of the Obama-Sanders meeting?
After the meeting, Sanders said he will do everything he can to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president, but didn't really offer an endorsement to Clinton. Now, there is an interesting new hashtag from Bernie Sanders supporters. Seeing his chances of winning at this point is rather low, They're reluctantly showing support for Clinton. And that reluctance is apparent in the new hashtag, "Girl, I guess I'm with her." That's a long hashtag, by the way. And that's a wordplay on Clinton supporters' hashtag, I am with her. Jim?
Well, I'm sure this will evolve just like the campaigns over time. Maybe we'll get a shorter hashtag. But always a great wrap-up from G. Abby Lee. You may tweet your questions and comments to our International Edition stream. That's found at VOA_IE. Tag G and myself on those tweets. The handles are VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories trending right now in Asia, Japan summons Chinese ambassador over sea spat. Indonesian police arrest 3 suspected Islamic State militants. New Zealand Prime Minister to make milestone trip to Fiji. Indian Prime Minister charms U.S. lawmakers with humor. Indians turn to illustrated novels to tackle social issues. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Several suicide attacks killed more than 20 people Thursday in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, despite the traditional truce for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Edward Uranian has more for VOA from Cairo.
Thick clouds of black smoke poured from vehicles that caught fire following the explosion of a car bomb in Baghdad's eastern district of Al-Jadida. Pieces of metal and other debris littered the normally busy commercial thoroughfare as stunned residents milled around and sirens blared. A boy spoke with a policeman explaining how he had seen a car explode minutes earlier. Rescue workers pulled victims from the rubble as ambulances ferried casualties to nearby hospitals. Al Jazeera TV reported the Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the car bomb attack in Al-Jadida. A second suicide car bomb blew up next to an army checkpoint in the northern Baghdad suburb of Taji, killing 7 soldiers, according to Iraqi State TV. The car bomb attacks Thursday coincided with the ongoing government offensive to recapture the Islamic State-held town of Fallujah 40 kilometers west of Baghdad. Government forces and their Shiite militia allies say that they have entered a southern district of the city. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi insists the morale of government forces is high during a visit to the front lines. He accused Islamic State militants of placing bombs in buildings, in vehicles, and under roads, slowing down government forces. He also accused Islamic State of using residents of Fallujah as human shields. Arab media report that Islamic State carried out 119 suicide attacks in Iraq, Syria, and Libya during the month of May. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A public funeral has been held for boxing legend Muhammad Ali. But first, a court in Papua New Guinea on Thursday granted an injunction preventing students from protesting on campus, boycotting classes, or barricading classrooms following Wednesday's clashes with police after they opened fire on student protesters, wounding dozens. The violence occurred on a school campus in the capital, Port Moresby, as students demanded the resignation of Prime Minister Peter O'Neill over corruption allegations. Mr. O'Neill has denied any wrongdoing, but has also refused to comply with a 2-year-old arrest warrant. Australian National University analyst Anthony Reagan follows PNG events closely, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty he's uncertain of the Prime Minister's culpability, but believes the violence stems from the political intrigue surrounding the removal of his predecessor in 2011.
The investigations of the Prime Minister relate to allegations that he authorized payment of some 30 million kina, about 10 million US dollars, to a law firm, part of a bigger allegations about corruption involving kickbacks on payments. The evidence against the Prime Minister is not particularly strong, but it's part of a picture of a much wider political struggle that's been going on in Papua New Guinea for some years. The Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, took over in 2011 from a government headed by Papua New Guinea's independence Prime Minister, Sir Michael Somare. Sir Michael Somare was thrown out by a parliament dominated by O'Neill when he was ill in hospital in Singapore. And the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court, in two rulings in 2011-12, ruled that Prime Minister Somare had been removed from office illegally. But the O'Neill government at the time refused to accede to the Supreme Court rulings and stayed in office against the ruling of the court. And there was a significant political and constitutional crisis. And the general perception, I think, of observers would be that to a large extent what's going on now is that those who lost out financially through control of the state are now seeking to get back. So a lot of what's going on is about stirring up as much trouble as possible for O'Neill with a view to getting him to step down and the opposition get into power.
Were you surprised by the violent response by police?
Not entirely. The police in Papua New Guinea have a pattern of violent behaviour, and there's particular elements of the police, a mobile squad, a riot squad element, which is used to end tribal fighting and riots and so on. And it's quite likely that some elements of those squads were involved. I think, though, there's now going to be a likelihood of violence spreading. It won't be the students, it'll be others. There's already reports of some looting of stores and so on, which is quite common in parts of Papua New Guinea if things get out of control.
Anthony Reagan says it's hard to say whether the country is headed toward crisis. He describes Papua New Guinea as one of the world's most diverse cultures, with more than 800 different languages spoken among its 8 million people. Most of the population is rural, but he adds if unrest breaks out in the two biggest cities, the capital and Lae, it could paralyze the energy-rich country. You can visit voanews.com for much more on this story. Also, follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out Facebook. Our page is VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This is VOA's International Edition. A Muslim funeral for Muhammad Ali Thursday drew thousands of admirers to the boxing's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, where mourners prayed over the body of a man who battled in the ring and sought peace outside it. An estimated 14,000 people representing many races and creeds attended the funeral in Arabic, where he was repeatedly described as the people's champion. Ali, a three-time heavyweight champion known for his showmanship, political activism, and devotion to humanitarian causes, died Friday of septic shock in an Arizona hospital. He was 74. Ali and his family planned his funeral for 10 years, making sure it would honor his Muslim faith while also adapting to the demands of Western media-driven culture. He's to be buried later today after a funeral procession and before one final goodbye, when thousands more will gather for an interfaith service. Luminaries, including former U.S. President Bill Clinton, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and comedian Billy Crystal will be attending the event. With Muhammad Ali's passing, the world is remembering the man who transcended sports, culture, and religion to become a global icon. I Am Ali, a 2014 documentary by Claire Lewis, used audio tapes he recorded with family and friends to paint an intimate portrait and portrayal of the boxing legend. VOA's Penelope Plou has more.
My father has a lot of sides, and you hear about the fights. You don't hear about family that much and what that meant to him.
What's your dad's name?
Muhammad Ali.
No one, not even some members of his family, knew of the existence of these audio tapes until recently.
Mario? Sir? You're now 11 years old.
They thread the narrative of the boxing champion's life in Claire Lewis's documentary. Ali's daughter, Hannah, offered the tapes to Lewis.
Say, I love my dad.
I love my daddy. I love my poo-poo-head daddy.
My father was always conscious about history. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why he made this series of audio tape cassette recordings.
Say, flow like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
The film shows the whole world in love with him. Testimonials of friends and adversaries paint the Olympian and three-time boxing champion, Cassius Clay, later Muslim convert Muhammad Ali, as a sensitive, poignant, and courageous man. Because he refused to serve in the Vietnam War, he was stripped of his championship title, and his boxing license was revoked. His close friend, former football player Jim Brown, remembers.
He had a lot of courage. The risk he had to take, and then to be isolated, to have his crown taken away, not be able to make a living, that was difficult.
But he stuck to his convictions, and in 1974, at the age of 32, Ali made a comeback.
When George Foreman meets me, he'll pay his debt. I can drown a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Wait till you see Muhammad Ali.
He defeated formidable George Foreman and recaptured his title.
I get into the ring with the guy. I bluffed him. I done everything. Beat him up basically for about five or six rounds. I thought it was easy. Then about the sixth round, he whispered in my ear after I'd hit him in the side, "That all you got, George?" And that was about all I had.
Imam Ali does not say much about his broken marriages, but it highlights his bond with his children.
I was the Concord of boxing. I was at a high altitude than the rest.
As Ali has aged, we hear him begin to slur his words, a sign of developing Parkinson's disease. He finally retired in the late 1970s, and in the mid-80s, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But to the world and his children, he remains an icon of power and grace.
If anyone wonder why me, Muhammad Ali, is making these tapes, is because history is so beautiful.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
There is truly only one Muhammad Ali. We are very fortunate to have so much video and audio to enjoy of him still. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, a big boxing fan himself. Engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. We'll see you again next time. Have a wonderful day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has granted KSH 380 million to Kenyan innovators as part of its Feed the Future Kenya Innovation Engine, or KIE, an effort to reward and improve agriculture-based innovations. To date, more than 57,000 rural households have benefited from KIE-supported innovations and attracted nearly $1.4 million in public and private sector investment. At a launch held May 31st in Nairobi, the agency granted funds to 10 local firms to transform simple agriculture initiatives into valuable projects in Kenya. Such projects have played key roles in improving incomes in individual households, while at the same time reducing poverty levels and improving food security among communities. Following a vetting process, six of these pilot rollout grants have already been awarded, and the Innovation Engine is poised to grant funding and technical assistance to an additional four advanced innovations, said Karen Freeman, the Mission Director, USAID Kenya and East Africa. Kenya Innovation Engine is a five-year program implemented in collaboration with USAID partner Land O'Lakes International Development that identifies, nurtures, and brings to scale innovative, private sector-oriented solutions to food security, undernutrition, and poverty. The Innovation Engine collaborates with entrepreneurs who design new concepts, products, and services to maximize their commercial value. The initiative was launched in 2012 with funding from USAID. Kenya Innovation Engine has so far provided seed funding and technical expertise to 22 innovations with a promise of more support for food security and social support initiatives. This initiative has contributed substantively to building the businesses and institutions involved in these areas, said Ms. Freeman. Among the benefits achieved by the initiative, more than 57,000 households reached by new technologies during the proof of concept stage, 30,000 farmers made a repeat purchase of the innovation. Smallholders have recorded $6.7 million in incremental sales since adopting these innovations, and enterprises created 1,458 jobs at the proof of concept innovation testing stage. The United States is proud to work with its partner Kenya to improve agriculture for the benefit of Kenyans and the Africa region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.